Welcome to the Hardware Asylum Podcast Extras. In this episode, we talk about many of the retro PC projects that we have on the Hardware Asylum YouTube channel. I'm your host, Dennis Garcia, and with me today, I have Darren McCain. For the past several months, I've been doing a YouTube series for the Hardware Asylum channel on retro PCs, where I'm basically building up and repairing some old computer hardware. This is 386, 486 era stuff, and I wanted to kind of share it on the extra this month.
I think that's a great idea. Now, of course, listening to the podcast is no substitute for watching these videos, but I think this is a great opportunity to give you an idea of what you might have missed if you haven't been following that channel.
Yeah, I will link the channel down below in the show notes, so if you are curious, please click on the link, check out some of the videos that we've talked about.
Of course, like, subscribe, share with your friends, play it daily, you know, all that usual YouTube-y stuff.
Yeah, of course. All right, so I'm going to let Darren go and drive this one. He can just kind of quiz me on some of the stuff that we've been doing.
Perfect, because I've been following these things. Now, I confess from the get-go that I'm not a big retro PC guy. So this is one of the areas where Dennis and I differ because, of course, he's got a huge closet full of hardware, and I'm always trying to get rid of my old hardware.
In reality, I mean, I should also come clean here. Retro PC stuff just interests me because I like the era. I've used it before. But in terms of how you use it, it's kind of pointless. It's kind of worthless. I mean, I built up a nice 386, which we can talk about. It's got an RLL hard drive, which is loud and noisy, has absolutely no space. I had to add an SD card so that I actually had some storage, which we can talk about. I don't know what to do with that machine because it only runs Windows 3.1.
Well, I think this is kind of in that same realm of the folks that restore classic cars, right? There's a subset of people that think that's exciting and cool. Now, cars maybe have a little bit of an advantage because you can get in them and drive them and show them off, right?
Where, oh, yeah.
With the car PCs, shows. You don't really have that opportunity. But there's still some good stuff here, and I think some of these things could translate, I don't know, to modern PCs, at least initially, which maybe is a great way to talk about this first article because, to me, this is where I started to get a little interested. Let's start with this one, repairing a battery damaged 386 motherboard. Now, this is a really interesting thing to me because for so many years, I felt like motherboards were fragile. Capacitors especially. Mm-hmm. The batteries for the BIOS would go bad, all that kind of stuff. And in my world, it was a throwaway technology. So I didn't have the means or the ability to repair motherboards. So talk me through what you're trying to do here.
In the 386 era, manufacturers started adding a real-time clock to the motherboard that would control the time and the date. Before that, on, was it 8088s and the 286s, those particular machines, every time you booted it up, you had to enter the date and time. And that was how it maintained what the current day was. So when you would write files, that would be the timestamp on the files. Well, with the 386, they started adding this real-time clock. And to store that data, much like on a modern motherboard, you need to have a battery. Well, they put rechargeable batteries on these motherboards. And you know what rechargeable batteries do?
They don't survive. Because they...
they don't survive. And the alkaline inside them leaks. And sometimes it will leak in a week. Sometimes it will leak in 12 years. Sometimes it may never leak. I mean, I have one motherboard that's stored away in my collection vault. Brand new. The battery looks brand new. It hasn't leaked at all. Knock on wood or plastic or whatever this table is right here.
Right.
Well, this battery damaged motherboard was one that I got in a eBay find. And the battery leaked. And basically it spills out all of its corrosive juice. Once it leaks, it starts to eat all the copper. And it'll eat the copper between the layers in the PCB if it's gotten really, really bad.
Yeah, that's not good at all.
So what I did for this particular video is I removed all of the damage. So I took my desoldering tool and removed the battery and then took some vinegar to clean up the battery damage. And then there was a couple of components that had some decorative chrome gold pieces on it that were also damaged. They just kind of, I'm not sure how this stuff works, but it just kind of adheres and moves. I guess it's maybe like a little salamander or something, something like that.
Similar to rust, I think.
But you would think that the damage would just be localized, but this kind of spreads out. It's just kind of weird. So I removed the keyboard jack, and there was a couple of other components that had gotten damaged. So I desoldered those and then replaced them with some donor parts off of some other motherboards and put it all back together. The interesting thing here is the fact that while there is a lot of damage, once you neutralize the acid or the base, in this case, you can repair them. So if there's a damaged trace, you can put a bodge wire or just a piece of copper wire and solder it in place to re-establish that connection. And so while this motherboard should have been thrown away because it has a leaky battery on it, it can be repaired. So in the video, I talk about the pieces that were damaged, and we go through with the desoldering tool and remove the keyboard jack, for instance, and then I replace it with a donor one that is also gold plated. So in a sense, I kind of restored this motherboard. I got lucky with this particular one in that the battery didn't damage any of the traces to the point where I couldn't repair them. They still were all connected. All I needed to do was take some solder and tin over them so that they were reinforced, so to speak.
So degree of difficulty on this particular project?
Probably a 5. You need to have some soldering skill. You need to have a few specialized tools. While you don't need to have a desoldering station to repair a motherboard like this, it does make it a lot easier. Like, I've removed components with just a soldering iron where you can just kind of heat it up and you pull the wire out of the board. But getting the wire back through there when there's a bunch of solder in place, that is an exercise in futility, or however you want to say.
Sounds very frustrating.
Yeah, it's not good.
All right, interesting. Let's jump to the next one here. So for your next project, you were working with the Magitronic Mini Tower. So walk us through that.
So the Magitronic Mini Tower, this is a project that I call the Classic Case Build. And I'm not sure why I came up with the name Classic Case, but it had a design that I had never really seen before. So a lot of the retro mini towers, especially the ones that I built back in the day, they all had these vertical fins on the front that acted as kind of decoration, a little bit of venting. The speaker was back there behind it.
Yeah.
Well, this particular case had the very similar dashboard setup where it had the case badge and then the LED display for turbo and non-turbo. And then we have the reset turbo switch and then the key lock. Well, the slots go horizontal instead. So it was really a very unique design. And I noted in the video that down in the corner, it had a spot where he could plug a keyboard into the front of the case.
Oh, wow.
Which is something that you don't see except in, you know, what is it, like data center servers, where you can plug the keyboard into the front because it's a pain in the butt to get behind the rack to go and plug in the keyboard and whatnot. So. And to plug it into the front, all it was an extension cable that plugged into the jack in the back.
Oh, no.
So you couldn't plug in two keyboards, obviously. It's just you would either run to the front or you'd plug into the back.
So you have to plan ahead.
Yeah. But I liked this particular case because it had all of the features that I like in a retro mini tower, where we have the rocker switch, the thunk thunk on and off sort of switch. It had the dash panel, which I just talked about. Well, in this particular video, and some of the other ones as well, because this was a 4 or 5 segment project, in this one, I took it apart. So we looked at the plastic that had been yellowed because ABS from that era just kind of turns yellow after a while. We took the motherboard out, which was a 386 40 megahertz that has slightly different design where it had a large socket in the bottom, which I later found out supported 46 processors. So you could disable the onboard 386 chip and then put a 46 in there.
Oh, nice. Upgradability.
Yeah, which is something that was a bit rare back then, where you'd have to really throw away your whole motherboard and replace it completely. But then again, you know, that's kind of the upgrade mentality that we liked during that era.
Well, and those parts were relatively cheap. I mean, at least in comparison to building a new system versus repairing it.
Yeah, exactly. And it had a lot of other classic components, like we had the 5 1/4 external drive, and we had a 3.5, which was brown for some stupid reason. I don't think I've ever seen a brown floppy drive before.
Yeah, that's odd. Replaced at some point, I think.
Yeah. And inside there was the variety of components. I think the modem had been removed previously, but there was a Trident style video card in there, along with a couple of controller cards. And I later found out that the panel must have been off of this case for a really long time, or it was in a workshop or something, because the bottom of it had paint overspray.
Oh no.
All over inside the case. And it had gotten also on the motherboard, to the point where if you plugged in a card into one of the slots that hadn't been populated before, it didn't work. So it was just kind of damaged by environment, or so to speak. There's an expansion bay cover that has some slots in it. And if you look in the video down in the bottom, you'll see an imprint of that same bay cover in the bottom of the case,
funny.
Which is from the overspray masking, you know, because that was just kind of sitting there, which is pretty crazy. This particular build also had some battery damage on the motherboard, which I did replace. And this one was a bit more severe in that it broke a bunch of the traces. So there's a whole video, which we can mention a little bit later, where I had to put a couple of bodge wires in there and solder them across to remake that connection.
Wow, that's a big level of effort for that one. But an interesting case and an interesting build.
Well, and it was an ongoing project. One of the next ones here was my RetroBrite process.
Oh, now let's talk about that a little bit, because I'm not sure that I knew what RetroBrite even was prior to this video.
And I learned about RetroBrite as part of my research for this. I hadn't known that you could do this. But it turns out that the chemical process with the ABS, there was, some chemical that started with a B that was mixed in with the ABS as a fire retardant, because ABS plastic, it burns pretty well. And it'll burn for a really long time, unless you can have something in there to prevent that from happening. Well, this chemical being added, and the fact that the ABS was white or beige, made it to the point where this chemical would react with oxygen and turn yellow.
That's so funny, because we've talked about beige boxes for so long, and now we are trying to return them to beige again.
Yeah.
Or and white, I guess.
And I feel bad about rebuilding or restoring cases like this, because for the longest time I would go and pull that panel off and then treat it with a nice chemical so that I could paint it and color it something else. Although I found later on that by doing that, I made the plastic extremely brittle, to the point where you could actually touch it and poke holes in it. So ABS is a bit fickle in terms of manipulating it. Well, some say that the RetroBrite process does the exact same thing. It damages the plastic. But the process is pretty simple, in that you take hydrogen peroxide, some UV light, and a bit of heat. And those three things together will convert the yellow back to the normal beige color that the plastic was originally.
Oh, I didn't realize it's sort of like a fancy bleaching process then.
Yeah, it is, in a sense. It's kind of like bleaching hair. And the heat is kind of a key element that a lot of people forget. And I picked this up from my mother, who was a hairdresser. And as you know, a lot of women go and have their hair bleached so that they can color it something else, or just they want to be blonde again. When the roots grow out, they change back to their natural color. So to convert those, you put the hair bleach at the roots, and then you just let the person sit there, and the heat from their head will go and convert the hair back to that bleached color. Otherwise, they need to apply it to the hair and go under a dryer. The key point here is that you're adding heat. And if you don't, then it will still work. It just takes a lot longer. And that is why I have this little tub here to show you. We have some items again. We're going to, you know, this is radio, but we're going to be moving some stuff around.
Okay. So this looks like a Tupperware container. I'm guessing this is an acid bath then?
Kinda. It's this is a Rubbermaid tub, actually. But this is a clear plastic tub, and it's about the size of a mini tower front bezel, so that, you know, once you remove all the components from the bezel, I can put it in here, and then I submerge it in a hydrogen peroxide solution bath. Since I have connections in the cosmetology world, right. I was able to get a hold of some 40 volume clear developer. And for people that are not aware, that is basically hair bleach. And the 40 volume is the volume of hydrogen peroxide against other chemicals that are mixed with it. It works out to be about 12% hydrogen peroxide. That's important because the hydrogen peroxide you can buy from the store is about 3% and not really concentrated enough to work for retrobriting. And anything higher than that, and you can start making explosives and rockets and stuff, and you need to have a special license.
Well, that's really interesting.
So the way that this works is I have a thermal relay, and Darren was messing around with this earlier, but I basically have a beverage heater, which is one that you can plug into the power port inside your car and plug it into your drink, you know, heat up your coffee that's been in there for 4 days or whatever.
So it's just like a little heating coil, if you will.
Yep. You can plug that in. Well, for this particular process, that heating coil will heat up the hydrogen peroxide solution and maintain it at a certain temperature. To help me with that, I have a thermal relay, which is that green box right there. And I wire that in series with the heating coil and plug it into a 1200 watt power supply. I'm using a Cooler Master brand. It doesn't really have to be 1200 watts, but I figured, hey, with the overcurrent protection, I figure if something shorts out, then I'm not going to burn the house down.
So this monitors the temperature, keeps it pretty constant.
On the module, there's a thermometer that plugs in, and you can program the relay to either heat or cold based off of the temperature you plugged into it. So I programmed this one to be at 50 degrees centigrade, which works out to be like 120 degrees Fahrenheit or something like that. And it will activate the beverage heater until it reaches that temperature. And as long as I don't have more than, 2.5 liters of fluid in here, that will maintain whatever temperature I want.
Very nice.
Once I start adding more fluid, then the beverage heater has a hard time keeping up.
So how long does the bezel need to be in the solution?
I have found the magical number to be 4 hours.
Wow. Okay.
In addition to just heating it up, I need to apply some UV light. And for that, I'm using just your standard off-the-shelf UV LEDs. And I attached those to a piece of cardboard and then wired them in parallel so that they all get equal amount of voltage, and then plug that into the same 1200 watt power supply. And I'm just using Molex plugs, which is nice.
Yeah, that is nice. And I think the pictures of this thing are really interesting too. It's very sci-fi.
Yeah. And it reminds me of, again, some of our retro builds where we used to put UV lights inside our computer.
Yeah, I missed that.
Which is
UV reactive components. They need to bring that back.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit ironic because people claim that the UV light is what changes the color of the ABS plastic to make it yellow. I argue that maybe the UV light has a component, but it's really heat. You know, you leave this thing by the window and the side of it's going to heat up. And just the fact that sunlight is there providing the heat just kind of makes people think that it's UV light that does it. But, and now we have computers where we have UV lights inside them, whereas before we would try to remove these computers from that environment.
That's a crazy world we live in. But also the evolution of cases away from ABS.
Yeah. I did this RetroBrite process on 3 bezels. There are 2 of them pictured in the video. And then there is a 3rd case, which is in a future video that I did off camera.
Excellent. All right. So it looks like after that, you did some fan upgrades. Now, I like this project because we're modernizing the retro PC in a way.
We are. So in the classic case build, this is again a video in that series, I basically took the 200 watt power supply, the AT style power supply that came with the case, and I was testing the LED display on the bezel. And I was wanting to make sure that it said the right numbers because once you press the button, it changes. It doesn't actually reflect how fast the computer's running, but it does show a number. You can make it say AA or BC or whatever you want it to say. Well, I wanted it to say 40 and 20, and it was doing 40 and 10 or something like that.
Not there.
Yeah. So anyhow, I fired up the power supply that came out of that case, and the fan was just horrendously loud. And I recognized it as being just bad bearings. Fans of this era had a typical problem in that the riflings would just kind of wear out. They didn't have very good lubrication and bad tolerances. And what would happen is that as they wore out, they got loud as they started to vibrate around. The fan in the power supply had that problem, and I decided, well, I'm going to fix this problem permanently. So I picked up an 80 millimeter fan from Noctua. It's a Noctua Redux nice industrial style fan. It offered higher airflow than the stock fan that was in the PSU with at a third of the noise level. It turned out to be extremely silent.
Well, Noctua is famous for that, of course. I would always recommend Noctua fans for silencing any build, really.
Yeah.
But they are not pretty, but they do kind of fit in with the retro look.
The thing with the classic Noctua is that they are brown and tan.
Right.
When you get into the industrial style fans, they have this dark gray fan center, and then the shell of it is a lighter gray.
Oh, interesting.
So it fits into more of a, well, their industrial thought, at least. And once it's inside the power supply, you don't see anything except just a little bit of the gray frame. The nice thing here, though, is all I needed to do was take the fan tail off of the existing fan and solder it to the new one, put a little bit of heat shrink on there, and then just reinstall it. It worked perfectly, made it extremely quiet.
Super easy. I like it. Now we're almost done here. The last one in the series so far.
So far, at least, yeah. Is, in its title, I will go and read this one. I put a Microscience HH1060 in my Retro 386.
That's a very nerdy title.
Yeah, it's a super nerdy title. And it was really more or less to appeal to people that were looking for keywords and stuff. Microscience was the name of a super high-end hard drive brand back in the PCAT era. This was like in the mid-80s. And for those that know a little bit about old hard drive technology, this was the MFM hard drive or the RLL hard drive, pretty much the predecessor to IDE.
Oh, okay.
Which is also old. The thing with these hard drives is that they're small. The one I put into this build was only 66 megabytes. And to put that into perspective, I can take maybe 3 photos on my phone and fill up this hard drive.
Wow, that's tiny. I forgot how small they are.
And back in the day, though, when you were just running DOS apps and whatnot, everything had to be installed off of a floppy disk. Well, you could put, 66 floppy disks worth of data on this hard drive. And back then, that was quite a bit. That was really all you needed. But, of course, in today's world, I can't even install Windows 3.1 and DOS and one program on that hard drive before it fills up completely.
I bet.
But the idea of putting this hard drive into my Retro 386 was, one, because I had the ability to do it.
All right.
And two, because I wanted to have that that old style sound. It's more or less kind of a reflection of what I did for my S10, where I put Corvette brakes on it. Well, it has a 4-cylinder 5-speed. It definitely does not need 6-piston brakes off of a Corvette Z06, but it looks the part. It looks awesome. Well, in this case, I wanted something that sounded old and sounded retro. And when you turn these hard drives on, it sounds like a jet starting up, literally.
Well, that definitely brings back the retro feel. I know these days we're used to things getting quieter and quieter thanks to SSDs and the lack of rotational drives. But this is a little interesting. And that worked for you. How did that work out?
Well, it took a lot of ingenuity, so to speak. So with a 386, you did not have a hard drive controller on board. So when you bought the motherboard, basically all you had was a keyboard connection, a spot where you could install memory, and you had 8 expansion slots. Well, and of course, then the CPU. Within those expansion slots is how you added features to your case. Now, the 386 was designed and built during the IDE hard drive era, so they didn't build any provisions in for supporting these old hard drives. That was really designed for the IBM XT and the IBM AT, kind of the 286 era, a good 3 years before the 386 got released. But there are cards that came out, and they would be supported in these systems much like you would install a SCSI card in a modern system. So while your modern ASUS motherboard will have an onboard controller for SATA or M.2 or whatever, you can install a SCSI card and Windows will recognize it as a secondary controller. Well, that's what I had to do to get this RLL hard drive installed, was to put in an RLL controller. An RLL is basically the interface that is used to contact the hard drive. I have to program it as being the secondary controller so that it doesn't interfere with the way that the BIOS was set up to look for an IDE hard drive.
Well, I was just thinking, if you're using an adapter, how does it know if it's a primary or a secondary or Does it do cable select? Or how does that work?
Well, yeah, cable select was an IDE term. And even for cable select, you needed to have a jumper on the drive to be able to tell it where it was on the cable chain. Well, with the 386, you needed to set a bunch of jumpers. And this is something that we really take for granted with modern hardware, is that once you plug in a card, the BIOS will go and look at it and say, oh, well, you need to have these sorts of resources, so we're going to put you right here. And then it just gives it an address. And it does that every time your computer boots up. Well, with these old machines, you need to set the jumpers and then recognize that this address is now being used by this card. This address is being used by the processor. This address is being used by the math coprocessor. And that is one of the problems that people had when building these computers, was that you'd plug in something and you would have a conflict and it wouldn't do anything at all. Honestly, I had some growing pains putting this computer together, because when I installed the card, it was conflicting with the IDE controller that I had installed as well. So it was trying to take over that C drive spot. And I really kind of wanted it to be the C drive, but I needed to rejumper it to make it the D drive, or, you know, cable select second.
But spoilers, right? You did get it to work?
Spoilers, yes. I did get it to work. And it worked exactly how I described. So basically, the computer sees it as a SCSI controller or a secondary controller. I have an SD card to IDE adapter running as my primary C drive. It works as a standard 512 megabyte
so hard
drive. And that's what's recognized by DOS and by the system BIOS. And then the D drive is now this 66 megabyte RLL drive, which it works great. I can go and save files on it. I can run games off of it. And it's not terribly slow, as slow as you would think, at least. Of course, the SD card I have as the primary hard drive makes the system boot up amazingly fast. It doesn't take any time at all. And then if you try to load something off of the floppy drives or the other hard drive, it takes a little while, but it's not as bad as you would think.
Interesting. Well, I know this is the last article you published, but I know this is not the last project. So give us a kind of a sneak peek at what's next.
Well, the next project I have is, it's actually on the table, which you can't see, but it's going to be a Resto mod. So I'm going to be building a Pentium 120. And so it's going to use vintage hardware, but I'm going to intermix with modern components. So I'm going to put in a Silverstone SFX power supply, going to be putting in an actual SSD. So I'll have to have an adapter card that will convert SATA into IDE, so it'll plug into the onboard controller. And then I'll be intermixing other memory and video cards in there. But the idea is that I'm still using the old components, but then I'm replacing all of the weak parts, one either being slow or something that was prone to blowing up and burning your house down.
We don't want that to happen. Well, all right, it's a good-looking PC for an old beige box. I'm looking forward to it, I think.
Yeah, I would urge everybody to go and check out the Hardware Asylum YouTube channel. Like, comment, subscribe, and let me know what you think. For more information on the topics discussed in this podcast, please consult our show notes on hardwareasylum.com. Stay up to date on the latest at Hardware Asylum by subscribing to our RSS and follow us on Twitter. This has been a Ninja Lane production, copyright 2022. Thanks for listening.